She touched his cheek. "You are just enough for me." Then his words reached her.
"Poor? What do you mean, poor? Poor is sometimes a figure of speech. Do you mean poor?"
"From my ruin, I salvaged my clothes and Ella's. Little more."
"Mama," Hattie cried, "I warned you. What will we tell people? I knew Ella."
She was drowned out by Mum Olga's wails.
"You didn't love me. You deceived me, my love."
He drew her against him. She sobbed into his cloak.
"Are we poor?"
Olive asked, her voice rising in panic.
"Is our money gone? Will we starve?"
"Hush, Olive," Hattie said. "We are not poor. Ella is poor. We must pity her." But she was interrupted. Mum Olga had stopped crying and pushed herself out of Father's arms. She reached across the coach and pawed at me, ripping my reticule from my waist.
"What's in here?"
She dumped its contents on her lap.
"Coins? Jewels?"
"Only a comb and a handkerchief." But she examined the comb.
"Silver filigree. I'll keep it."
She tossed the purse back at me and then lunged again. The carriage lurched while she clamped onto my bracelet and attempted to pull it off my arm. I tried to push her away, but she held fast. Father pulled her off me and held her hands in his.
"Olga," he said, "we love each other. What else matters? Besides, when I travel again, I'll earn back all I lost and more."
She paid no attention.
"I will not have that pauper live like a lady in my house. She can earn her keep. Olga, my heart, I expect Ella to be treated with respect," Father said. "She is not to be a servant in her own home. Do you understand, my sweet?"
Mum Olga nodded, but she sent me a look of pure venom.
"Mama, I'd hoped when we were richer we could..."
A footman opened the carriage door. We had arrived at my new home. My trunk was carried through shadowy hallways to a guest room that was richly furnished but oppressively dark. The chambermaid lit three lamps, which illuminated but did not lighten the effect. She turned down the bedclothes and left me. I wished Mandy would come in to say goodnight, but she wouldn't arrive from our old home until the next day. I was alone with my fears. What would happen to me here? How would Mum Olga punish me for Father's deception? And how soon would Hattie resume her tyranny over me? I didn't have long to wait for Hattie. She issued her first order the next day. She gave it when one of the men servants announced that Char had come calling. He had come to see me, but she told me to keep to my room while she entertained him.
"You'll only be in my way, dear."
"He wants me. You'd be in my way."
"Go to your room, Ella."
She patted Mother's necklace. "The prince belongs to me, too." In my room, I banged on the floor, hoping Char would come to investigate the noise. But the walls and floors were too thick for him to hear me. Afterwards, she said,
"At first he may have wanted to see you, but I won him over. When he bid me goodbye, he said our conversation would stay in his memory forever."
He came the next day, too, and I was again confined to my room. I passed half the time of his visit standing at my door, trying to force myself to emerge from the room and from the curse. The other half I spent at the window, watching for him. When he left, he glanced back for a final view of our manor. I started to wave, but he turned away. An entry from his journal appeared in my magic book the night he left for Iortha. He had seen me.
"Ella is avoiding me. Twice I visited her house, only to be told she was out calling. On both days, her stepsister, Hattie, said Ella would return shortly, so I waited for hours, but she never came. When I gave up yesterday, I looked back for a last glimpse of her manor, since I couldn't have a last glimpse of her. But there she was, standing at an upstairs window. I should have returned immediately and insisted on seeing her, but I was too confused. Why was she there? Was she hiding from me? Was she angry? If she was, she should have come into the drawing room and told me. I thought her forthright enough to do so. I resolved to visit again in the evening and demand to see her. But when I got home, Mother had a surprise family party waiting to bid me farewell, and I couldn't leave. This morning I would have gone too, but Father was impatient to be off, and there was no delaying him. Perhaps she's embarrassed about sliding down the stair rail and blames me for encouraging her. Perhaps her father and his new wife were displeased. I had wanted to tell her about the afternoon I spent flying down the stair rails at home, never noticing the gradual shredding of my breeches. That would have made her laugh. She makes me laugh so easily. I always wish to return the favor. Instead, I had to listen while Hattie chattered endlessly. I don't know how she managed to pour the words out while smiling so hard, revealing the largest teeth I've ever seen. She must be excellent at cracking nuts. This is unkind of me. Her teeth are on the large side, nothing exceptional. The younger stepsister, Olive, said little, but the little was astonishing. She wanted to know whether people had to give me their wealth if I told them to. When I asked her why I'd want to take my subjects' money, she was surprised. "To become richer," she said, as though stating the obvious. All this I endured while Ella hid, and now I won't see her again for a year. I had to write to him. If he thought I was angry, he might never write to me. But how could I explain my behavior? The guest room I occupied was supplied with writing paper, ink, and a pen. I trimmed the pen, then found I didn't know how to begin. I could call him Char quite easily, but writing it was another matter. Dear Char looked disrespectful on the page. Dear Prince Charmant, or Dear Highness, seemed too formal. And how would I conclude? Yours truly and sincerely seemed stiff, while your friend seemed childish. Omitting the salutation, I began. It would be addressed to him, so there should be no mistake. I have been confined to my room. I saw you come to visit, and saw you leave. I waved, but you must not have seen. Father is vexed with me. It has nothing to do with you. He was insulted that I left the wedding early. 2 more days remain to my sentence. Now that you are gone, and I can no longer hope to tell you goodbye, it is not so terrible. I hope you will still write to me, and not only about Ayurtha. I have many questions, most of them impertinent. When you were a boy, did you study with other children, or did you have tutors all to yourself? I suppose you were equally wonderful at all your subjects, but were you? Who took care of you when you were small? When did you discover you were a prince, and would someday be king? What did the knowledge mean to you? If my questions offend, please do not answer any of them. I went on to tell him about my years before Mother died. Games with Mother and Mandy, the taste of tonic, listening to fairy stories. I omitted only the most important facts, Lucinda's gift and that Mandy was a fairy. Then I promised. In my next letter, I shall tell you more about finishing school, and the elves, and Arita, my Ayorthian friend. If you write quickly, I shall also send Mandy's and my recipe for roly-poly pudding. Cooking is another of my accomplishments, although not taught at finishing school. You may try the recipe and astound your hosts. If you do write, pray do not address the letters to me, or mark them to show that you are the correspondent. Direct your letters to Mandy. She'll see that I get them. You are shocked that I have proposed a subterfuge. My only hope is that one who flies down a stair rail as beautifully as you do can overcome his scruples in this matter. As my Ayorthian friend would say, Aduma ubensu enuse ansordo, or please write soon. I closed with your impatient friend, Ella. Somehow, the adjective made the rest less childish. I went back to the beginning and added Dear Char as the salutation. But how was I to address the letter? I had no idea where he was staying. In the end, I directed it to the royal family in Ayurtha and prayed it fell into helpful hands. Now I could only wait for a reply. In the meanwhile, what would I have to endure from my stepfamily? Chapter 23.
3 days after Char left, Father went too, off to be a merchant again. Before leaving, he spoke to me privately in the small parlor he had converted into his study.
"I'll leave at noon," he said. "Thank heaven the fairy left me my will and my reason so that I can leave, although I shall long for my Olga every moment I am gone. What a gift! If I could take this knife," he touched the scabbard at his waist, "and carve out the part of my heart that belongs to my wife, I should do it."
He would never hurt himself. "Why must I stay with them?" I asked.
"Where else can you go? You fled finishing school, and you'll be in better society here than you would find with me, including me. Don't run off again."
"You are better society than they are," I said. It was true. There was a little honesty in Father, but none at all in Hattie or Mum Olga.
"This is praise indeed. Come, tell your father goodbye."
"Farewell."
"I shall miss you, child."
He kissed my forehead.
"I prefer to love my wife from afar. I shall not soon return."
"I don't care." But I found that I did. As soon as Father's carriage disappeared from view, Mum Olga swallowed her tears and directed a manservant to transfer my belongings to a room in the servants' wing. With a tiny window and no fireplace, it was more cell than room, just large enough for a pallet on the floor and a small wardrobe. It was cold now in late November. In winter, it would be a chamber of ice. After my things were moved, Mum Olga sent for me. Hattie and Olive were with her in the rear parlor that faced the garden. I took a seat near the door.
"You are not to sit in the presence of your betters, Ella."
I didn't move.
Mum Olga sputtered. "Did you stand, Ella?"
Hattie commanded. I fought for a moment, then rose. Hattie put her arm around my shoulders.
"Ella will be obedient, Mama. Tell Mama how obedient you'll be."
"Very obedient," I mumbled, while grinding my heel into her toe.
She yelped in pain. "What is the meaning of this?"
Mum Olga asked.
"The meaning, Mama, is that Ella does whatever she is told. I don't know why, but she does."
"Really?"
Hattie nodded.
"You mean she would have listened to me, too?" Olive said.
"Clap your hands 3 times, Ella,"
Mum Olga commanded. I clutched my skirts and stiffened my hands at my sides.
"It will take a moment," Hattie said. "She tries not to. See how red her face is?"
I clapped. "What a clever daughter I have," Mum Olga beamed at Hattie. "As clever as she is beautiful," I said. They both began to answer me and stopped, confused.
"Hattie isn't pretty," Olive said.
Mum Olga rang her bell. In a few minutes, 2 housemaids entered the room, followed by Mandy and the rest of the servants.
"From now on, Ella will be one of you," Mum Olga said. "Teach her to be a good servant."
"I'll take her for my helper,"
the laundress said. I stifled a cry. On my first day in Mum Olga's manor, I'd seen the laundress blacken the eye of a housemaid. Mandy spoke up.
"I need a scullery maid. I know the lass. She's stubborn, but trainable. May I have her, your ladyship?"
Since the wedding, Mum Olga had been eating Mandy's cooking, in ever-increasing helpings. By now, she would probably have given Mandy 50 scullery maids to keep her happy.
"Are you certain you want her if she's so obstinate?"
"I'll take her," Mandy answered. "The chit means nothing to me, but I loved her mother. I'll teach her to cook, and your ladyship can train her for other service. But I'll allow no harm to come to her if your ladyship takes my meaning."
Mum Olga puffed up to her full height and girth.
"Are you threatening me, Mandy?"
"No, mistress. Bless me, no. I want to keep my situation. But all the fine cooks in Kyria are my friends, and if anything happened to the wench, I don't know who would cook for you."
"I won't have her spoiled."
"Spoiled? I'll work her harder than she ever worked in her life, and give you a fine cook into the bargain."
The bargain was irresistible. Mid-morning of my second day of servitude, Olive joined us in the kitchen.
"I'm hungry," she said.
although breakfast had been only an hour earlier.
Make me a white cake.
Mandy began to assemble the ingredients.
No, I want Ella to do it.
She stood at my side while I measured and mixed.
Talk to me.
What should I say?
I don't know. Anything.
I told her a fairy tale about a prince with a long nose who loved a princess with a short nose. The tale had humor and grief, and I enjoyed telling it. Over her cooking, Mandy chuckled and sighed at the proper moments, but Olive only listened silently, her eyes riveted on my face.
Tell me another,
she said, when I announced the end, suspecting she wouldn't recognize it otherwise. I recited Beauty and the Beast. My mouth was getting dry. I pumped water into a cup.
Give me some, too,
she demanded. I refilled the cup. Was I going to pass the rest of my life catering to this appetite?
Another story,
she said when she finished drinking. She said the same after Rapunzel and Hansel and Gretel. Before she could order one more after the tale of King Midas, I asked her hoarsely if she'd liked the story. She nodded, and I persuaded her to tell it back to me.
A king turns everything into gold and lives happily ever after. I want more!
Not a command. I've told every story I know.
I want money.
Perhaps she was thinking about Midas.
Give me your money.
I had gotten only a few KJs from Father before he went away, which I hoped to keep in case of need.
Don't you want Ella to finish making your cake?
Mandy asked.
I thought you were hungry. No, I want her money.
Olive's voice rose. Mandy tried again.
What does a rich young lady such as yourself want with the wee savings of a scullery maid? To make me richer. Mother and Hattie have much more than I do, she started to wail. It's not fair.
My head hurt from not obeying, as well as from Olive's noise. I pushed the mixing bowl away.
Come with me.
My money was in my room, at the bottom of my carpet bag. I hunted through it without letting Olive see my Agulon wolf or my glass slippers. She probably wouldn't have recognized their value, but she might have talked about them to her mother or to Hattie. I had only 3 silver KJs, enough to buy a few meals or a night at an inn. Olive counted them twice.
I have to put them away.
She closed her fist over them and marched off. I was penniless, stripped of the power that even a few coins bestow. For a quarter hour, I sat on my bed, enjoying the quiet and trying fruitlessly to think of new ways to break the curse. Then I returned to the kitchen to help Mandy with lunch. When I entered, Olive was there.
Talk to me, she said.
In the evening, there was to be a formal dinner to console Mum Olga for Father's departure. I had to wash the floor in the hall in preparation while Mum Olga came by frequently to supervise.
You must scrub on your knees and add lye to the water. It scours best.
As soon as I submerged my hands, they smarted and burned. I drew them out of the bucket.
Don't stop before you've started. The dinner is tonight, not next week.
The task took 3 hours, but my knuckles were bleeding in a quarter of the time. Occasionally, other servants passed by. Some gawked. Some seemed sympathetic. Nancy, the serving maid, came during one of Mum Olga's inspections. She crept behind Mum Olga and pantomimed dumping a pail of water over her head.
Something amuses you?
Mum Olga asked. I shook my head and stopped smiling. At last I finished. In addition to bloody hands, my knees were bruised and my arms ached. I wished I were a real servant, the sort who could quit one situation and seek another. I returned to help Mandy in the kitchen. Fortunately, she was alone. As soon as she saw me, she rushed to her store of herbs and unguents and to the jug of tonic.
Sit down, sweet. I'll have you good as new in a minute.
Her remedies worked miracles, but better yet, during dinner I had revenge. Mandy had just sprinkled parsley over 30 servings of trout, and Nancy was ready to convey them to the guests.
Wait!
I dashed to the herb cabinet. Here. I scattered ground passiflora over one of the plates. Give this one to my stepmother.
What?
Nancy looked startled.
Don't do it, Mandy said. I won't have her ladyship blaming me when she starts snoring in front of her guests.
Oh, is that all? Serve her right.
Nancy took the plate and was off.
A good lass, Nancy,
Mandy said, grinning at me when she had gone. Two servants had to carry Mum Olga to bed before the meal ended, but the festivities continued, culminating in dancing. I witnessed the dance because Hattie called me to tend the fire, and everyone saw me in my greasy, sooty state. Afterward, while I undressed in my room, I thought about escape. Mandy would only use small magic, which was smaller help than I needed, and Char was hundreds of miles away and mustn't know of my troubles anyway. Father! I hated to ask him for anything, but he was the only one who could help. I would write to him. Chapter 24. In my letter, I played on Father's pride and described the part of my servitude that would most enrage him, tending the fire in front of the courtiers. How dare they treat me so, and against your express wishes, too. They order me about, and the more menial the task, the better. I beg you to come home. Many merchants trade right here in Frel. Why can't you join their number? Please come. My need is great. You know I would not ask otherwise. Come quickly. I am counting the days. Your daughter, Ella. I gave the letter to Mandy to post. Perhaps it would overtake Father on the road. The mail coach driver knew him. It might reach him before my earlier letter got to Char. Father could even be back in a few days. Until I saw him or heard from him, I would endure. I stayed out of my stepfamily's way as much as possible, and the longer I worked as a scullery maid, and the filthier I got, the less Hattie and Mum Olga tormented me. I think they gloried in my squalor as proof of my baseness. From Olive, though, there was no respite, and to escape from her, I hid. My most secure hideaway was the library, although I never dared stay long. I was able to steal half hours reading Mum Olga's dusty tomes. No one ever thought to look for me there, or to visit for pleasure. I don't know whether I was more anxious to hear from Father or from Char. I kept thinking about Char and wishing to talk to him. If I thought of a joke, I wanted to try it on him. If I had a serious idea, I wanted his opinion. Although weeks passed without an answer from Father, my first letter from Char arrived only 10 days after I'd sent mine to him. Then letter followed letter for the first 6 months of his absence, while I heard nothing from Father and saw nothing of him either. As I had directed, Char sent his letters to Mandy, who pretended to have an admirer. Hattie and Mum Olga were vastly amused at Mandy's romance, but I failed to see why it was any more absurd than Mum Olga and Father. Char's hand was large and round, the letters evenly spaced, each fully formed, completely unlike my crabbed, spiky writing. His showed a balanced, honest nature, while Arita used to say mine proved me imaginative, impulsive, and always in a hurry.
Dear Ella, my name has been changed. Here they call me Escharmont, which sounds more like a sneeze than a name. They can't pronounce Char, and I can't persuade them to call me Eschar. They are so formal. They say by your leave more often than they say anything else. The Iorthians think before they speak, and often conclude, after lengthy meditation, that nothing need be said. The loudest beings in an Iorthian council are the flies. The occasional bee that finds its way in is deafening. I long for conversation. The ordinary Iorthians are talkative, but the nobles are not. They are kind, they smile easily, but speech for them is a single word, occasionally a phrase. Once a week they utter a complete sentence. On their birthdays, they grant the world an entire paragraph. At first I chattered to fill the silence. In response, I received smiles, bows, thoughtful expressions, shrugs, and an occasional, perhaps by your leave. So now, I keep my speeches to myself. In the garden this morning, I overtook the Duke of Andana. I touched his shoulder in greeting. He nodded companionably. In my mind I said, "The flowers are marvelous. That one grows in Kyria, but that other I've never seen before. What do you call it?" In my imagination, he answered me, naming the flower, saying it was the queen's favorite, and that he'd be happy to give me seeds. But if I had really asked about a flower, he'd probably have continued strolling. He'd have thought, why does this prince clutter up a lovely day with talk? If I don't answer him, he may breathe in the sweet air, feel the gentle sun, hear the rustling leaves. Perhaps by now he regrets his question, but perhaps he thinks me rude for not answering him. However, if I speak now, I may startle him. Which would be worse? It would be worse to have him think me rude. I must speak. But, exhausted by his cogitation, he'd have energy left for only one word, the name of the flower. I'm writing nonsense. In my first letter I had hoped to impress you with my brilliant prose, but that will have to wait for my second. Not many of my imagined conversations are with the Duke. Most of them are with you. I know what I would say if I were in Frel. I'd tell you at least 3 times how glad I was to see you. I'd speak more about Ayortha, and with fewer complaints. And I'd describe my trip here, especially our adventure, when one of the pack horses shied at a rabbit and tore off. But then I might turn Ayorthian and trail off into silence, lost in smiling at you. The trouble is, I can't guess at your response. You surprise me so often. I like to be surprised, but if I could supply your answers with confidence, I might miss you less. The remedy is obvious. You must write to me again, and quickly, and again, and more quickly. Your very good friend, Char.
In my reply, I gave him conversation. Greetings. How do you fare today? Lovely weather we've been having. The farmers predict rain, however. They say the crows are chattering. Ah, well, what weather will do us good, I dare say. We can't have sunny days always. Life isn't like that, is it? Wish it were. Wouldn't that be fine? Never a disappointment, never a harsh word. Don't you agree, sir? A fine fellow such as yourself, you have sense enough to see it's never that way. In one dose, I hope I have cured you of your desire for conversation. My pen stopped. What could I tell him? I couldn't explain my servitude without telling about the curse. Then I recollected that Mum Olga had recently held a cotillion. I described it, omitting the detail that my participation had been limited to removing the dirty plates from the refreshments table. Char's reply was that the Ayorthians didn't have balls.
They have sings, which are held monthly. 3 or 4 Ayorthians at a time occupy the stage in turn and sing long, sad ballads, or happy tunes, or funny ones, joined by the whole throng in the choruses. The entire populace knows thousands of songs, and there is hardly a mediocre voice among them. Sound gushes forth from somewhere deep, their toes or their souls. For the last song, a paean to the rising sun, because they have performed through the night, they gather their families about them. Husbands and wives and children clasp hands, tilt their heads heavenward, and release their music. And I, seated with the few other visitors, add my weak voice to theirs, humming when I can't guess the words, and wishing my hands were held too. Perhaps we can come here together some day. By the way, you are a month older than the last time I saw you. Are you still too young to marry?
I chuckled at the joke. Then I thought of the bride I'd make, in a threadbare, sooty gown that stank of cooking fat in yesterday's dinner. Char repeated the query in every letter, probably because my answers were so silly that they pleased him. If not too young, I was too tired to marry, or too wet, or too cross, or too hungry. Once I wrote, "If my years are measured by inches, then I am certainly too young. The 11-year-old daughter of an acquaintance dwarfs me." The acquaintance was Nancy, the serving maid. Another time I wrote, "Today I am too old to marry, 100 at least. I've spent the last 80 years and more listening to a lady detail the pedigree of every dinner guest tonight." The lady had been Hattie, and I had not attended the meal. I continued in a more serious vein. "I have not found anyone in my stepfamily circle in whom I can confide, and there are few subjects about which my stepsisters and I share an opinion. It is great good luck that I have a pen and paper and a friend." Char's answer?
"My tongue may wither from disuse here, but at least I shan't lose words entirely while I still can write to you."
Sometimes I wondered what would happen if I told Char that I was just the right age to marry. With each of his letters, I fell more in love with him. But I couldn't tell him. If I said I was old enough to marry, and his question had only been the continuation of a good joke, he would be horribly embarrassed, and our easy friendship would be ruined. He might stop writing, which I couldn't endure. If he wasn't jesting, it was for him to say so. Until then, or never, I treasured our correspondence. In his next letter, he wrote,
"I don't know when I learned I would be king. It seems I've always known it. But two stories are told, and I've heard them so often they seem to be memories. One has me as hero. The other is not so flattering. A lute was given to me when I was 6, and my sister Cecilia was 4. She coveted it, and plucked at it whenever she could. Finally, I presented it to her, an act that signified to the servants that I would be a generous king. They never considered how indifferent a musician I was. My protestations that it was a small sacrifice to part with something I had little use for were taken as modesty, another fine kingly quality. However, I'm not sure how modesty figures in my retelling the tale to you. I do so because I want you to know I have qualities that others admire. What you will conclude from the next anecdote, I cannot guess. I was in the streets of Frel with my father when a man pelted him with an overripe tomato. While wiping at his clothes, my father spoke kindly to the man and ended by resolving his grievance. Afterward, I asked why the man hadn't been punished. When father told me I'd understand by the time I became king, I said I didn't want to be king if people threw tomatoes at me. I said it seemed a thankless task. Father roars with laughter when he tells this tale. Now I know why. It is a thankless task, but tomatoes are the least of it.
The conclusion I drew from this story was that Char wasn't above laughing at himself. Of course, he wasn't perfect. Eager to share his knowledge on any subject, he neglected to ascertain the interest of his listener, or, in my case, reader. He wrote more about Ayurtha than I ever wished to know. How the guilds were structured, the number of gallons of milk produced in a year by one Ayurthian cow, the construction of their manors, and yet more. This was a minor flaw. He confessed a more serious one.
"You are almost my sole confidant in this. The other is my horse, to whom I tell everything, because he can't condemn or offer advice. I write it to you, because you must know all. I trust you to find the good in me, but the bad I must be sure you don't overlook. I am slow to anger, but also slow to forgive. For example, my languages tutor had a way of making me feel a fool. I endured his abuse, but learned less than I might have if he'd been encouraging. Cecilia, who inherited his instruction after me, received the same treatment. The first time I found her crying, I warned him. The second time, I dismissed him. Father trusted my judgment enough to let my actions stand. I went further. Boy as I was, I took measures to ensure the tutor would teach no more. But although my victory was complete, and the man was ruined, and 6 years have passed, the thought of him still infuriates me. I am angry now as I write these words. You may excuse me on the grounds of being a kind brother, which I hope I am, but I wonder at my rage, and I wonder, too, if my action against the tutor was at bottom a case of refusing, in another form, to let someone throw a tomato at me or my family."
In reply, I wrote, "Mandy says there are two sorts of people in the world, those who blame everyone else and those who blame only themselves. I place myself in a third category, among those who know where blame really lies. You stand condemned. Your crime, too much zeal in the protection of those you love. A fault and a virtue. Heinous. Although you have revealed your shortcomings to me, I feel compelled to know such frankness. You must discover my faults for yourself, and although you've said it goes against the grain, you must find a way to forgive them. I remember the date of Char's next letter, Thursday, May 24th. He'd been gone half a year. Although the letter arrived in the morning, I was unable to read it all day. At dawn, I had to scrub the flagstones in our courtyard for Mum Olga. Then Olive ordered me to count her coins in their thousands, repeatedly, because she kept thinking I had made a mistake. In the evening, Hattie had me help her prepare for a ball. including plucking out the hairs that grew in profusion above her upper lip. By the time Hattie departed, I was too late to help Mandy clean the kitchen. The rest of the night was mine to use as I liked. In my room, I opened my little window and let the cool air wash over me. Then I lit the bit of candle Mandy had smuggled to me, placing it carefully out of the breeze. I sat on my cot and opened my letter. "Dear Ella, impatience is not usually my weakness, but your letters torment me. They make me long to saddle my horse and ride to Frel, where I would make you explain yourself. They are playful, interesting, thoughtful, and occasionally serious. I am overjoyed to receive them, yet they bring misery. You say a little of your daily life. I have no idea how you occupy yourself. I don't mind. I enjoy guessing at the mystery. But what I really long to know, you do not tell either. What you feel. Although I've given you hints by the score of my regard. You like me. You wouldn't waste time or paper on a being you didn't like. But I think I've loved you since we met at your mother's funeral. I want to be with you forever and beyond. But you write that you are too young to marry, or too old, or too short, or too hungry. Until I crumple your letters up in despair, only to smooth them out again for a 12th reading, hunting for hidden meanings. Father asks frequently in his letters whether I fancy any Iorthean young lady, or any in our acquaintance at home. I say no. I suppose I'm confessing another fault. Pride. I don't want him to know that I love if my affections are not returned. You would charm him, and Mother too. They would be yours completely, as I am. What a beautiful bride you'll be, whomever you marry, at whatever age. And what a queen, if I am the man. Who has your grace, your expression, your voice? I could extol your virtues endlessly, but I want you to finish reading and answer me quickly. Today I cannot write of Iortha, or my doings, or anything. I can only post this and wait. Love, it is such a relief to pen the word. Love, love, Char. Chapter 25. I gaped at the page, read it again, and gaped again. In my daze, I noticed that my sooty thumb had left marks on the letter. He loved me. He'd loved me as long as he'd known me. I hadn't loved him as long, perhaps, but now I loved him equally well, or better. I loved his laugh, his handwriting, his steady gaze, his honorableness, his freckles, his appreciation of my jokes, his hands, his determination that I should know the worst of him. And most of all, shameful though it might be, I loved his love for me. Placing my candle carefully, I danced and whirled around my room. I could marry Char and live with my love. I could leave Mom Olga and her spawn. No one would give me orders. This was an unexpected solution to my trouble. Lucinda would have hated for me to evade my obedience by rising above it, and even Mandy would be surprised by this method of ending the curse. I extracted paper from the hiding place at the bottom of my wardrobe. My love shouldn't have an extra moment of impatience. However, my stub of a candle flickered out as soon as I wrote, "Dearest Char, darling Char, beloved Char." I ordered my mind to wake me the instant there was light enough to write by. Then I fell asleep, composing my letter. In the middle of the night, I awoke, my happiness draining away. I wouldn't escape the curse by marrying Char. I would be more cursed than ever. And he would be cursed, too. Suppose my obedience were discovered. My stepfamily knew, and would take advantage to improve their rank and fortune. But that would be the least of it. An enemy of Kyria could put the curse to more awful use. In unscrupulous hands, I would be a powerful tool. I could be made to reveal state secrets. I could even be forced to kill Char. And I had no doubt my secret would be discovered. In court, there would be eyes and ears that would be alive to such signs. I'd never manage to fool them all. What could I do? Mother had ordered me not to tell anyone about the curse, but Mandy could countermand the order, so I'd be able to tell Char. Then he could take precautions. I'd tell him. I'd wake Mandy now. I sat up in bed, happy again. and sank back.
What precautions could Char take? He could prevent anyone from speaking to me or writing to me. He could shut me away. That might do. But he would have to bring me my meals, the flax to spin my clothes, the wood for my fire. It would be a burden similar to one of Lucinda's wedding gifts. And what would Kyria think of a hermit queen? And how would I feel, locked away like Rapunzel in her tower? Moreover, even the best precautions might fail. I could ask him to give up being crown prince in favor of his sister. If he were never to be king, he might not be a target. But how could I ask such a thing? How could he accept? And would the danger simply move to his sister? We could keep the marriage a secret. That was absurd. The secret would get out. I cast about for other ideas, but none came. Cursed, I couldn't marry him. But if I ever managed to break the curse, in a month or in 20 years, I would find him and win him over again if he was still free. No matter what I had to do, no matter how long it took. But now, my only choice was to convince him to give me up. When I finally thought what to say and began to write, I ruined 3 sheets of paper by crying on them, and a 4th because I forgot to misspell words. My dear Prince Charmant, your latest correspondence with my stepsister was received by my mother, Dame Olga, and myself. Ella and the cook Mandy were not here to accept it. Ella is absent because she has eloped, taking our cook with her. She left a note, which I have enclosed for your perusal. You have been much deceived in her. It was her custom to read your letters aloud to us and crow over them, thinking it a feather in her cap to be writing to royalty such as yourself. For a while, she had ambitions to be queen, but she despaired of it and took another offer. She would go into one of her dreadful rages if she knew the contents of your letter. I do not think she liked living on our generosity, and longed to be able to lord it over us with greater splendor than we could hope for, although we fancy that our style is very fine. Your letter arrived 4 days after her departure. I know because Demby had a ball that night, and Ella was greatly missed. Her beau turned to me for consolation, and I gave them the same advice I have for you. Think no more of the minx, because she has already forgotten you. I am sorry to dismay you, but I hope you will be consoled by the fond wishes of this admirer, your angel of comfort, Hattie. I tore a sheet of paper in half for the enclosure, written in my own hand. These are the first words I ever penned as a married lady. You know him, but I shall not write his name, only that he is very old and very rich, and lives far from Frel, and he is fool enough to make me his bride. Some day, and the day may not be long in coming, I shall be sole mistress of a vast estate. I shall not write again, but look for me. When my husband dies, I shall visit Frel. Should you spy a carriage that surpasses all others, peer inside. You will find me within, smiling at my jewels and laughing at the world. Ella. Char's anger at his tutor would be nothing compared with this. He would hate me until the end of the world. In the morning, Mandy dispatched the correspondence, thinking it an ordinary letter. I didn't tell her about Char's proposal, for fear she would think I should accept him. Although I knew I was right, I doubted I could withstand any argument. As soon as she left to post the letter, I collapsed in front of the fireplace, sobbing. When she returned in half an hour, I was still in tears. She gathered me in her arms. "What's the trouble, sweet?" For a few minutes, I continued to cry too hard to speak. When I was able to control myself, I told her. "Did I do right?" I asked at the end. "Come with me, lady." She grabbed my hand and half-dragged me to her room, passing several servants in the hall. Once there, she closed the door and turned to me. "Lady, you did right. Now I'm going to do right, something I should have done long ago. Get behind the curtains, love." I hesitated, pushing back the urge to obey. "Why?" "I'm going to settle scores of scores with Lucinda. I want you to see me do it, but I don't want her to see you." I hid. "Lucinda, I need you." The scent of lilacs filled the room. I stifled a gasp. I could see Lucinda's outline through the rough weave of the draperies.
I never thought the day would come when the kitchen fairy would call me. I'm delighted. How can I help you, dear?
Don't dear me, Mandy sighed. But you're right. I need your help.
And I love to help.
Safely hidden, I grimaced at her. I have been gathering my courage to ask you ever since the fairy ball.
One has only to ask.
Mandy sounded regretful. At the ball, I got into an argument with Kirby.
You shouldn't have. I never argue.
But I do. It was about you. Kirby said we should suggest you try being a squirrel and try being obedient. If you gave it a fair trial, 3 months as a squirrel, 3 as an obedient human, you'd find out that your gifts aren't so wondrous after all.
I don't have to try out my gifts to know they're magnificent.
That's what I said you'd say. There, I can tell Kirby I won the argument. I said you'd be too afraid you were wrong to put it to the test.
Lucinda vanished. She must have been too angry at Mandy to continue the discussion. But then Mandy laughed.
Don't forget to be obedient, little one. Here's a nice walnut. I'm sending you to a comfortable park.
She paused.
You can come out, lady.
Did she really turn herself into a squirrel?
I emerged cautiously.
She did.
Mandy was still laughing.
Do you think she'll learn? If she doesn't, she's even more of a blockhead than I think.
What if an animal eats her?
If that happened, I'd fear for the animal, she chuckled. What a stomach ache it would have.
If she learns her lesson, will she undo all her gifts?
I don't know. I just had to stop her mischief. You may yet break the curse yourself.
But if she discovers how wrong she was, she'll want to lift the spell.
Maybe, but it would be more big magic.
Mandy drew me into a hug.
Oh, love, I know what that spell does to you.
I pushed out of her arms.
You don't know! And how can you warn against big magic when you just summoned Lucinda? Nothing one fairy does to another is big magic, lady. Stop calling me lady! You used to call Mother that. Now you're a lady, too. If you'd put yourself first and married the prince, someone would have come along to harm him, and Kyria, sure as cabbages. You're a heroine, sweet.
I'd rather be his wife. The tears welled up again, and I threw myself across Mandy's bed. She sat next to me, stroking my back and murmuring,
Oh, sweet, my lady. Perhaps it will come right.
She shifted her weight. Something crackled, and she exclaimed,
What's this? Oh, I forgot. When I posted your letter, there was one for you.
She pulled the letter out of her apron pocket.
I flew up. It's not in the prince's hand, love.
It was from Father, saying he wouldn't come home. My servitude pained him, but not enough to return him to the arms of his odious, though beloved, wife. He wrote,
When I find a husband for you who is rich enough to satisfy me, you will be released from my Olga. Until then, I urge you to be, as always, my stalwart daughter.
I fell back on the bed, laughing wildly. Father would make my letter to Shar come true. He would marry me off to an ancient man who would soon die and leave me enormously wealthy. The irony. I couldn't catch my breath. Tears ran down my face, and I didn't know whether I was laughing or crying. Mandy held me until I quieted. While she rocked me, I thought that Lucinda still might save me. Mandy might be wrong. Once Lucinda knew how it was to be obedient, she wouldn't be able to leave me cursed. She'd have to help me. A week later, I saw in my magic book that Shar had received my message. I opened to an illustration in which he was burning my letters. I was glad to see his image, no matter what the image was doing. After I gazed a while and ran my fingers over his shape, I turned the page and found an entry in his journal.
I've lost nothing. She was never what I thought her, so I've lost nothing. I'm only fortunate, and Kyria is blessed, that she eloped before my letter reached her. When I received the message from her sister, I thought it had been a ploy to make me hate Ella, and I resolved not to be taken in. For a while, I considered leaving Eortha to discover the truth. Gradually, however, I realized the truth was in my hands. The sister could have no reason to lie to me. If Ella and I had married, she would only gain. But Ella's note convinced me in the end. It was in her hand, and the last phrase about smiling at her jewels and laughing at the world was certainly her own. She charmed me as easily as she did the ogres. I never did discover why she hid after her father's wedding. She was probably avoiding a lovesick swain, not wealthy enough or ancient enough to suit her. Her avoidance of me after the wedding was another trick, the meaning of which is too deep for me to fathom. But her letters were the greatest deception of all. She seemed so good-hearted, but I suppose that's the way with such women. They wouldn't be minxes if they weren't masters of artifice and fraud. How she must have laughed when I confessed my faults to her. There was more. In addition to minx, he called me flirt, harpy, siren, enchantress, temptress, and even monster. He ended by writing, "I wish I weren't in Eorthe. The silence here offers too much time for thought. 1,000 times a day I swear never to think of her. At least I can promise never to write or speak of her again, and can force my pen and my voice to keep my word." I endured 6 months of Hattie and Olive and Mom Olga by imagining my freedom when Lucinda released me from the curse. I didn't give up writing to Char. Since the new letters were never posted, I told him the truth about my life in Mom Olga's household. When Hattie told me that this earl or that duke loved her, I laughed over the absurdity of it to him. When Olive made me count her money again, he was informed. Every day she invents new hiding places for her wealth. There are coins in the hem of her gown, coins sewn into her sash, and coins buried in the stuffing of her waist roll. With all the metal concealed about her person, she had best not set foot on a boat. When Mom Olga had me clean out the root cellar, and I found a tabby with her litter of kittens, Char learned of my delight. And when Mandy taught me cooking secrets, I shared them with him. I also described my future without the curse. "My first act," I wrote, "will be to confess that I love you. I'll beg pardon 1,000 times for causing you unhappiness, and make reparations by making you laugh 1,000 times. The night before Lucinda's reappearance, Hattie awakened me when she returned from a cotillion. She said I had to help her prepare for bed. I had never had to before, so I waited to learn her real reason. "Tonight they talked of nothing but Prince Charmant's return next month," she began while I undressed her. I knew exactly when he was coming home, so why was my heart beating so? "They say that King Gerald is going to hold 3 royal balls to welcome him. They say the prince will pick his wife at the balls. Ouch! Be careful!" I had stabbed her with a stay. For once it was accidental. "Mama says if I..." I didn't hear anything more. Were the balls Char's idea? Did he really mean to find his bride there? Had he forgotten me? Could I make him remember when Lucinda freed me? Hattie dismissed me eventually, and I spent the hours till dawn imagining my release from the curse and thinking about my reunion with Char. I couldn't decide whether I should steal one of Mamolga's horses and ride to Eorthe to surprise him, or whether I should wait and amaze him at the balls. In the morning, I woke Mandy and tried to convince her to feign illness so she could call Lucinda immediately. But no. First, we had to prepare Mom Olga's breakfast and wash all the dishes. And Mandy wouldn't use the smallest magic to speed the process. When we were through at last, Mandy and I repaired to her bedroom, and I hid as before. This time, the room didn't fill with the scent of lilacs when Lucinda arrived. From my hiding place behind the curtains, I heard a rustling noise, and then the sound of weeping. "Stop sniveling," Mandy said. The weeping became louder, more despairing. "I can't." The music and lilt were gone from Lucinda's voice. I heard panting as she fought to catch her breath. "But if I were still obedient," she puffed, "I would have to stop crying just because you told me so." More sobs. "What did I bring on those poor, innocent people? How could I have done big magic, and so carelessly?"
"Your gifts weren't a boon?"
I'd never heard Mandy be sarcastic before. "They were dreadful.
terrible, Lucinda wailed.
I wondered if her experiences had been at all like mine.
What happened? Mandy asked, her voice kinder.
It was much worse to be obedient, but being a squirrel was bad enough. Half the time I was cold and wet, and I was always hungry. I never got a decent night's sleep, because I was too cramped, curling up in knotholes. Once, an eagle carried me off. I was only saved because it flew into a violent storm and dropped me over a tree.
And when you were obedient?
I turned myself into the 8-year-old daughter of shopkeepers. I thought it was only fair to be a child, since I always bestowed obedience on infants. I suppose my parents meant well, but they insisted I eat the most awful food, and I had to go to bed before I was sleepy. My parents wouldn't let me disagree with them about anything. My father loved to read parables aloud, and I had to listen to every word. They commanded me to think about the morals, so even my thoughts had to be obedient. And all this I suffered at the hands of good people who loved me. If anything had happened to them, I shudder to think what would have become of me.
You won't bestow any more gifts, then?
Never. I wish I could take them all back.
I stepped out from behind the curtain, even though I'd promised I wouldn't. Please do take them back. Chapter 26. Lucinda gasped. I gasped, too. She wasn't Lucinda, or was she? The enormous eyes were the same, but not the height. This fairy was stooped with age, and her perfect skin was wrinkled, with a mole next to her nose. I was seeing the real Lucinda, unshielded by magic.
"Mandy, who is this? You brought a human to spy on me?"
She straightened for a moment, and I saw a hint of the young, beautiful Lucinda. Then she sighed.
"You look familiar. Are you one of my victims?"
This was my chance. The chance for the freedom I always should have had. The chance to escape from my stepfamily. The chance to win Char back. But I was so nervous, my voice was gone. I could only nod.
What did I do?